Oh, say can we see by the one light in all our earth to embrace at the call of all nations where our children can play in a world without war where we stand hand in hand in the grace of creation where the rivers run clean through the forests of green where the cities stand tall in the clear skies of freedom. Oh, say do our hearts sing out for harmony and love forever on the planet of our blessed with peace on earth.
Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. And you can hear us live at accesssacramento.org, or you can hear this program and past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program is from the Peter B. Collins Show and includes Ted Rall's Anti-American Manifesto and William Durst. Ted Rall talks about his new book, Anti-American Manifesto, and William Durst on Democratic Whiners.
You know, if you read bin Laden's messages, he often talks about how, you know, Muslims aren't afraid to die for an idea. Islamists aren't afraid to die for an idea, but Americans won't die for anything. And, you know, I've observed that firsthand. I mean, you know, in Afghanistan, there have been many instances when I was really afraid and was shot at, and I had to keep a brave front for the Afghans around me. Otherwise, they would have lost all respect for me. And that happened recently. You know, I think as far as I could tell, myself and the two cartoonists I went with to Afghanistan were the only three unembedded American reporters in the entire country. Every other American reporter is traveling with U.S. troops, and they just didn't know what to make of us, you know, the authorities, the local Afghans, even the Talibs we met. They were like, what are you doing here? You know, American reporters don't talk to us. They talk to troops, you know, and I won't even get into the ironic fact that they're actually exposing themselves to more danger by traveling with the troops, because the troops are the target, not journalists. But they think they're safer. They feel safer because they're traveling. They're wearing Kevlar. They're in armored personnel carriers. But they're wrong. But they think they are, and everyone perceives them as being cowardly and afraid. And you know, I'm living proof that you can go all over Afghanistan through Taliban-held territory without weapons, without body armor, and be perfectly fine. And you can, it's, in fact, I think it's really the only way to go. We need to put ourselves out there. When I talk to Afghans about it, they would say, like, you know, you shouldn't come here, it's too dangerous. And I'd say, why, are you going to hurt me? And they'd laugh, and they'd say, of course not. And I'm like, so why should I be afraid? And they say, well, everyone else is afraid. Americans are always afraid. And it's like, and I said, well, I'm not all Americans are afraid. I'm not afraid. And then they'd laugh, and you know, we could have a conversation. I wish there were more Americans doing that.
Ted, I want to tell you about a concept that I developed. You remember Reagan was the Teflon president?
Of course. Who could forget?
Well, I coined a new phrase, Leflon. And I feel like the people at DuPont made a special product for Barack Obama. And that means that nothing coming to him from the left sticks. And I want to quote a passage here from your book. You say, "I was astonished by the tone of an article in the LA Times that reported the reticence of anti-war activists to protest Obama's decision to send more divisions to the war in Afghanistan, because so many of the would-be protesters had voted for Obama. That part didn't surprise me. What did was this quote from an anti-war activist: people are really burned out." And you say, burned out from what? 8 years into the Afghan conflict, there have been few major protest demonstrations against it. Burned out from having hoped Obama would ride in and save the day, and then being bitterly disappointed when he did nothing of the kind, just as he promised during his campaign? We must stop fooling ourselves. So how can we wake up the people who were willing to go to the streets to protest the wrongdoing of George W. Bush, but they are unwilling to challenge the guy who brought him the hopey changey thing? And you had a good phrase in there that I don't recall it exactly, but that basically said Sarah Palin's an idiot, but she made a prescient comment there, the hopey changey thing. What will it take? Do we need a challenger from the left to Obama in the primaries in 2012?
Well, any serious primary challenge to Obama would be obviously stand no chance of success. The system is rigged. These elections are rigged. There's no way to work within the system for real change. I mean, I'm convinced of that. I've seen it in election after election. I've paid close attention. I just don't see, from Ralph Nader not being allowed to participate in the debates to the way that John Edwards, pre-revelation, was drummed out of the primary campaign by the media because when he seemed to tack left. Just going all the way back to McGovern in 1972, it's hard to see how any agent of real change can possibly succeed under the system. The first thing that the left has to do is get real. They have to start thinking for themselves, and they have to stop participating in what I would call team politics. You know, where people look at the D's and the R's as sporting teams. You know, I'm a red, I'm a blue, and you know, blue forever. No, I mean, it's not a, you know, I don't care about Barack Obama. I don't care what happens to him. I care about issues. I care about Afghanistan. I care about the economy and jobs. I care about torture. I care about Guantanamo. I care about domestic surveillance. And so I don't care if Barack Obama is a nice guy or if I'd want to have a beer with him or, you know, even though I voted for Obama in November of 08, none of that is important. We need to get past that as a country. And I don't know how to teach people to think more critically. I mean, that seems more like it's a job for the schools, but I suspect that the schools deliberately don't teach that because it would endanger the system. So I don't know. I just don't know. That's, you know, the book doesn't really focus on that. The Anti-American Manifesto is a book that is dedicated completely to encouraging people to create the mental space to think outside of the two-party system and what passes for electoral democracy in this country.
Well, I don't know that
that's the purpose.
I don't know that Tom Six More Months Friedman has read your book, but in his October 3rd column in the Times, he writes, "Barring a transformation of the Democratic and Republican parties, there's going to be a serious third party candidate in 2012 with a serious political movement behind him or her, one definitely big enough to impact the election's outcome." Your comment?
Well, Thomas Friedman's always wrong, so that's pretty bad news that he says. I mean, you know, you can set your it's interesting because he's exactly in tune with conventional wisdom at any given point in time. So when it was time to go to war against Iraq, he was for that, although sort of with reservations. Then you know, when it started to go bad, he kind of wished it would work out, like most Americans did, but and hoped that we'd find the WMDs, but didn't. Anyway, the point is, I'm not going to get into Thomas Friedman's failings. I don't think that because they're too numerous for this broadcast.
Indeed.
But I think that he's I think he's, look, he may be right. Who knows? We may see a third party movement. If I were, you know, a George Soros, for instance, I would seriously contemplate, although he may not be able to run for president.
I don't think he can.
I don't think he was born in the United States.
Right.
So that's not going to work. But anyway, someone like that could emerge and run for office. And, you know, who knows? It might get further than Ross Perot and his, like, you know, Nazi frogmen that were going to disrupt his daughter's wedding.
And here's a paragraph from Friedman's column, which starts off in tune with you and then goes flat. He says, "We have to rip open this two-party duopoly and have it challenged by a serious third party. We will talk about education reform without worrying about offending unions. Financial reform without worrying about losing donations from Wall Street. Corporate tax reductions to stimulate jobs without worrying about offending the far left. Energy and climate reform without worrying about offending the far right and coal state Democrats. And proper health care reform without worrying about offending insurance and drug companies." I mean...
Well, you know, that's what passes for moderation in the New York Times op-ed page. You know, it's like that's like the rule of survival. It's the route to making $1 million a year as a pundit is to pretend like David Brooks, to be like, "Oh, I'm oh so reasonable." You know, on this issue, on the environment, I'm progressive. On tax, on creating jobs, I'm pro-corporate. Look at me, I'm so outside the box. No, actually, he's completely inside the box. I mean, the truth is that even the powers that be recognize that something has to be done about the environment. Corporate tax breaks for to create jobs.
Yeah.
Haven't they gotten enough?
Yeah, I mean, it's trickling.
And where are the jobs?
It's trickling down.
What we really need now is some nationalizations. We need the government to take over a lot of these companies that refuse to create jobs in the United States and use them to create jobs here for the American people.
Well, we own Citibank. We just didn't call it nationalized.
Yeah, you know, they're worth $14 trillion. I think that would probably do quite a bit to help the national debt.
So, Ted, toward the end of your book, you talk about what you consider to be a need, or at least a component, of violence to actually make a revolution work. You write, "If and when the crunch comes, any organized political party will be broken up. Its leaders and allies arrested, possibly jailed, tortured, and or executed. The police will be thorough. Any party or leader that is not broken up, co-opted, arrested, or forced underground, prima facie, obviously does not present a danger to the existing order. Otherwise, he, she, they would not remain free." So this is where I understand intellectually what you're saying, and you point out accurately that it was the street riots, the Abbie Hoffman route that occurred in Chicago in 68 that really galvanized people against the Vietnam War, that it was the riots across the nation in 1964 and 65 that really brought the racial issues to the point where people felt they could not avoid addressing them. So intellectually, I do understand what you're saying. But I personally am not prepared to grab a gun and go underground or form a cell to try to overthrow this government. And maybe I'm just a wuss. But that's, I guess, my point of departure.
You wouldn't be a good person to do it for the same reason that I wouldn't be a good person to do it. We're both public figures, and people know our politics. This has to be for people. This has to be for other people. This has to be for people who are not in the public, you know, not in the public realm. This has to be for someone who maybe lost their job and their life has been ruined and sees some way to act. It has to be like that. But it's not for us, and we're probably both too old for this anyway. But what this really is about is creating that, just allowing the possibility. Just think about it. I mean, the thing is that there's never been radical change without a violent component. It has to be part of the toolbox for a progressive. If you want incremental change, like, say, for instance, you know, it's great that gays can get married. I'm very for that. That kind of thing. You know, it's important for them, but it's incremental. It's not a big it's not an overarching radical change, despite what, say, you know, the right might say. And but if you think the problems are radical, you think the economy is a disaster, not going to get better anytime soon, if you think the environment's in deep trouble, if you're worried by the fact that we're going to have to relocate 140 million people because Bangladesh is going to be underwater in 40 years, if you worry about the mass die-off of coral reefs that was reported last week in the New York Times, if you think these things that we're out of time, like I do, then, you know, there's no, we don't have time to build a grassroots movement and slowly take over the Democratic Party over the next 50 years. There's not going to be anything left in 50 years. And by then, anyway, whatever's left, the right wing will be in charge of.
Well, Ted, I want to thank you for joining us today. I really enjoyed your book, and maybe enjoyed is not the right term, but I got a lot out of it, and I think that I do recommend it to my listeners as a good read, and they can decide for themselves how much they want to get active and what the price for their freedom truly is. But I think you offer a lot for people to think about. You build a compelling case that our system is broken, and I really am glad that you wrote the book.
Thanks, Peter. It was an interesting book to write, too.
Ted Rall. Visit him at rall.com, R-A-L-L. The new book is The Anti-American Manifesto, and it's out in soft cover from Seven Stories Press. And now, Will Durst has some comments for you here on the Peter B. Collins Show. And now, here's Will Durst with his commentary on the whiners on the left.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here with a couple of words concerning the president's attempt to bridge the midterm election enthusiasm gap. Good luck. We're talking about a chasm wider than the space between Christine O'Donnell's ears. The problem is, the right is all fired up, while the left is walking dejectedly around like a cheerleader who just got dumped by the quarterback Friday before prom. The situation has prompted the administration to slap its followers upside the head with a big old dose of tough love, altering hope and change to scold and chide. In Madison, Wisconsin, Obama castigated a rally of 25,000 supporters to buck up and quit their belly aching. And Vice President Biden actually yelled at a group of New Hampshire Democrats to stop whining. You see, progressives are disappointed in Obama. Apparently not every one of their little pet projects got passed in the last 20 months. So they whine and they grouse and they grumble and gripe and snipe and snivel and whimper and wail. He didn't pass the Rainbows in Every Pantry Act. He showed his true colors by failing to put an end to world hunger.
He's just a Republican in Democratic clothing.
And they believe it. Liberals don't do angry. They do petulant. They're not herd animals by any stretch. More like cannibalistic snails without teeth. Give them enough time and they'll gum each other to death. Doesn't matter if the Tea Party takes over the entire government. They're not voting because it would take time away from their precious pouting. So the president is forced back to the campaign trail in an attempt to recapture the enthusiasm of 2008. But I wouldn't hold my breath. He's got about the same chance as a meth head capturing pixie dust with a butterfly net. Of course, pixie dust is something the liberals can actually get behind. All together now, clap if you believe in Obama. I do believe in Democrats. For the Peter B. Collins Show, I'm Will Durst.
Hey, thanks for joining me for this angry episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. Email bigmouth@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.
There once was a time when everything was cheap, but now prices nearly puts a man to sleep. When we pay our grocery bill, we just feel like making our will. Tell me, how can a poor man stand such times and live? I remember when dry goods were cheap as dirt, we could take two bits and buy a dandy shirt. Now we pay $3 or more, maybe get a shirt that another man wore. Tell me, how can a poor man stand such times and live? Well, I used to trade with a man by the name of Gray. Flour was 50 cents for a 24-pound bag. Now it's a dollar and a half beside, just like a skinning off a flea for the hide. Tell me, how can a poor man stand such times and live? Schools we have today ain't worth a cent, but they see to it that every child is sent. If we don't send every day, we have a heavy fine to pay. Tell me, how can a poor man stand such times and live? Prohibition's good if 'tis conducted right. There's no sense in shooting a man till he shows flight. Officers kill without a cause, then complain about the funny laws. Tell me, how can a poor man stand such times and live? Most all preachers preach for gold and not for soul. That's what keeps a poor man always in a hole. We can hardly get our breath, tax in school and preach to death. Tell me, how can a poor man stand such times and live? It's time for every man to be away. We pay 50 cents a pound when we ask for stay. When we get our package home, a little wad of paper with a gristle and bone. Tell me, how can a poor man stand such times and live? Well, the doctor comes around with a face so bright, and he says, in a little while you'll be all right. All he gives is a humbug pill, a dose of dope and a great big bill. Tell me, how can a poor man stand such times and live?
Again, don't know where. That's all, folks.